Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of the Theater. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of the Theater Enthusiast Podcast. As always, my hot priest candle is lit. It's not really, but we're pretending it is, and I'm drinking out of my hot priest mug. Our next guest was just on Broadway in Take Me Out. I'm very excited he's here. I have been a longtime admirer of his work. Please welcome Bill Heck. There we go. Hey, can you hear it?
No.
Oh, no.
I think you lied to me.
Well, I'll tell you what. We kind of live close to each other. So, like, maybe if I, like,
If you
wander.
Clap really loud, just clap, try right now. Give me a little.
There you go. Can you hear it? Just
I
one
can hear it
person
out the
in
window.
my.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm a couple of avenues away from you and blocks up, but maybe I'll just, like, stalk the
The
street.
intention was strong.
Yeah.
It came across all the way.
I'll
Hell's
just
Kitchen.
like hit my
Yes.
applause app or do what you did, like the say anything, but with applause out of a speaker. Well, thank you so much for coming on. So
Thanks
I
for
always,
having me.
of course. So I always start with, where are you from?
I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and lived there till I was almost 10, and then moved to the Chicago suburbs for the remainder of my childhood
Very
through high
nice.
school.
Nice.
Yeah, desert to winter. Does
My
that?
winter is hard. My sister went to school in Evanston, right outside of Chicago. So,
Oh, Northwestern.
yeah, Northwestern.
Nice.
Yeah,
Nice. Yes. That's
not
a
to
lovely
like
spot.
Talk about her, but she has
Go
a
ahead.
undergraduate and graduate degree in journalism, so she's kicking ass. And well, she's now trying to get a job, but so, yeah, I've heard of the cold
Any
weather.
takers?
Yeah, anybody out there?
Yes.
Anyone? Great.
No.
She also likes comedy. Just putting out some feelers for
Hey.
her on this podcast, because why not?
Fantastic. Let's make it happen, people.
Yeah, of course. So what got you interested in performing?
My mom made me. That's not inaccurate. I it started in high school. Do you want the long or the short version?
That's up to you. I know Sweeney Todd was involved. I told you.
Yeah. Oh, you have done your research.
Yeah.
Yes. It was Sweeney Todd was involved. I was, it was a rough patch in my family in my formative years. And, I had been, a happy kid, good in school. And I come from this, always gone to public school except to junior high. I went to this small private school that my mom was working at to try and make ends meet, and so we got free tuition. So for junior high, I went away to this little school. There were 13 kids in my class, and oh my God, what happened?
No, I just heard like a gust of wind like against my window. Sorry.
This is a thrilling story, clearly.
Yeah, the gust of wind. You go into
Yeah,
junior
the
high at a private
tumbleweed.
school. Yeah. Well, we'll get there. I feel like you've had some like acting experiences where you might have acted where there was tumbleweed involved.
It's not an unfair presumption. Assumption. Yeah, so I came back out of this little,
I
high,
just
this
realized
little.
that sounds like you were like that your performance wasn't good. I meant like, you did the Coen Brothers film and it was a Western,
Yeah.
so there might have been a tumbleweed. So
I
that's what I
took
meant. Sorry.
I
Okay.
think either take is
Clarification.
probably was probably true at one point or another.
Perfect.
Anyway, I came out of this junior high into this back into this big public high school, and was in awkward stage and lonely and confused and unhappy because things were rough at home, and my grades fell, and I was a latchkey kid, and I was just generally morose, and kind of went through my rebellious dark years, which were very, very unspectacular. It amounted to like being sad and talking back to my mom on occasion. It wasn't anything terribly romantic, but it was notable enough that eventually my mom decided that what needed to be done was some participation, a little community and intention and activity. So she declared that I had to figure out some sort of extracurricular activity. And I played soccer all through junior high from when I was little. And so I decided I'd try out for the soccer team in high school. But by that point, my old cleats had become too small. We didn't have much money at the time. So my mom said if I'd made the team, then I could get new cleats. So I did my first day of tryouts in my old cleats. And at the end of that day of tryouts, my mom picked me up in the minivan. And I have a very distinct memory of jumping into the minivan and hopping into that middle seat, my feet hurting and taking off my cleats and both of my large toenails falling out. So I effectively had hobbled myself and could not complete the remaining 2 days of soccer tryouts. So my mom was like, well, you still got to do some extracurricular activity. I was like, fine, I'll audition for the fucking musical. And that musical was Sweeney Todd. And I have an aunt, my aunt Joan Wells, who spent many years as a professional singer in the Chicago area and sang, you know, with choirs at Carnegie and et cetera, et cetera. She helped me put together an audition and I kind of went for it.
Yeah.
Did you I was interested earlier than that
now that we're
the
really
part of the story
about it?
That never gets, yeah. The part of the story that never really gets told is I had been, you know, sort of always fascinated with movies and like the idea of running off to some place to, you know, play pretend. And so my freshman year, I actually went to try out for them. That was my junior year. Sweeney Todd was my junior year of high school. My freshman year, the freshmen were in a separate building in my high school. It was about a 10-minute walk from the main campus. And there was a morning announcement early on in the school year and about tryouts for the musical. And I convinced basically the only friend that I had kept from sixth grade over into high school to come with me to the main campus to audition for Guys and Dolls, which was sort of, I wasn't extending myself often then. So it's, you know, it's hard for me to remember what gave me the balls to do that in the first place. So anyway, we trekked over, and because we had to make the long walk, we were late and the doors to the auditorium were locked. And so we kind of knocked gently and they were flung open by the high school theater professor, who was this giant of a man named Tim Frawley, who is now a very dear person to me. And, but he's this giant bearded man with this booming voice, and he flings the door open, this just gorilla, and just shouts, "The freshmen are here." And I soil myself, and we walk, you know, down the middle aisle, and all these upperclassmen are staring at us, and it's terrible. They all look so cool and self-possessed and edgy. And, you know, the hot shit senior at the time was on the edge of the stage handing out sign out sheets, and you know, he had this long flowing hair, and he was like, "Blue for boy, blue if you got a dick, pink sheets if you got a vagina." And I was like, "Oh, these big words in front of the teacher." And and so we go up, we get our forms, and we start to fill it out. And it gets to, "What song have you prepared?" And I was like, "Oh, I just found out about this today. Happy birthday. No, let's fucking get out of here." And so we totally peaced out. And that was that. And I remember going, actually went to see Guys and Dolls. And there was some kind of longing attached to that experience.
Yeah.
So it wasn't completely random that after soccer failed, my next choice was
Sweeney.
To ante up again.
Are you excited for the Sweeney and, rehearsal? Do you have your tickets?
Oh my fucking God. I'm so excited. That's so
I honestly, I don't know Sweeney that well, but I am very excited about it. I have my ticket. I'm going like in less than a month.
Nice.
I'm just excited to be in the building. So
yeah. Yeah, but, it's one of the best. It really is. Yeah,
I've heard nothing but great things about it. So did you want to pursue, after doing Sweeney your junior year, did you continue to do theater in high school? And then you decided like, for theater?
It turned everything around. You know, I found a community and became a much happier person, and my grade shot back up. And, you know, it was in the course of that rehearsal process, I started to actually, I remember there's this girl I was parking with at the time. That's literally what we would do. It's a very old phrase, but it's literally what we would do. In this gorgeous old, commercial office building complex, which is really beautiful, romantic. But she opened my eyes in some other ways. In any case,
I feel like so many things out of this interview within the last 10 minutes, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
You really got right down to it. But I remember asking her, like, nervously, you know, did she think this was like a viable thing a person could potentially do for their life? Mm-hmm. And even asking the question, she was so cool and open. You know, there was no reason to be nervous having this conversation with her, but even kind of floating the possibility felt like really high stakes at the time, because there was something even then in me that recognized, can I want this?
Yeah.
And is it more than just, because, you know, my reasons for loving it and continuing obviously have shifted through the years. Mm-hmm. But I think even there was something even back then that was like, is this just like a fun time with friends? Like, mm-hmm. does that translate? You know, do I have the actual proper motivations to turn this into something, mm-hmm. a pursuit that takes my adulthood into consideration? Mm-hmm.
And in the parking lot, she said yes. And then you...
Yes, she was like, yeah, yeah. And then we made out for an hour and a half.
Perfect. Did she also try to pursue a career in that, or that you know of?
She did not. She did not. Yeah, she's a really fantastic writer now out in Seattle.
Oh, that's awesome. Sorry, I'm just moving my sweater that's on the back of my chair. I just threw it. See, studio apartment, not far from anything. So where did you end up going to college? And you studied theater there?
I went to the University of Evansville, mm-hmm. which is a smaller school in southern Indiana, right at the southern tip of Indiana, that has this really excellent undergraduate theater program. It's a little mm-hmm. sort of diamond in the rough, that is particularly adept at getting their kids into good graduate programs. And, you know, the whole tagline is a conservatory feel in a liberal arts environment. Mm-hmm. So I was glad to have a range of subjects, but also have really intensive theater training, knowing I would have to get my ass kicked if I wanted to be serious about it. Yeah. And I knew about it because I have an aunt and uncle who are professional actors in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. have made an excellent living for themselves working regionally there. And so they knew about it. And also, one of my still best friends, Nathan Johnson, who is now an acting professor and directing professor at University of Arizona Flagstaff, he played Sweeney. He was a year ahead of me. And he's a super amazing, intentional, driven dude. And so he really did his homework about where he wanted to study. And that was a place he landed on.
Just can't wait for you sort to see Sweeney Todd, and then you call him, be like, you were so much better than Groban.
I know that's true. I don't have to see Josh.
Yeah. I will say, I don't know if you watched The Office. I am a huge fan of The Office, but yes. There's an episode where Andy is in Sweeney Todd and Josh Groban plays his brother on the show. So there was like some tweet that went out saying like, Andy must be pissed that his brother is playing Sweeney on Broadway when he like played this other character.
God, I watched several seasons, but I didn't get it to that one.
I think that might be the eighth season.
Yeah,
I don't know how far into it you are.
No, I mean, there was in 2009, I moved back from Los Angeles to New York, and that's when I stopped. So whatever season of The Office that was.
It's fine. I mean, it's not as good when Steve Carell leaves, but, you know, it's a common thing. I know. I'm sorry. I still watch it. I'll probably watch it later tonight. So what made you decide to go to NYU for graduate school? Or was there like other schools you were trying out for? And then NYU was like, hey.
Yeah. Part of, as I said, the Evansville initiative is mm-hmm. pushing you onto a graduate program. So, I mean, it was a really intense initiative. The first semester of our senior year acting class was just about getting together 10 to 15 audition monologues. And then that following March, going up to Chicago and doing the Ertis auditions, which for those who don't know, is like there's a whole collective of colleges. I don't know what it stands for actually now. Ertis. But it's some association of theater training programs. You audition for like, I don't know, 60 schools in front. It's this big cattle call audition. And then they'll draw you in for one-on-one auditions. And then there's other programs that exist outside of that, like NYU and Juilliard and UCSD, Yale. There's like maybe 8 to 12 big graduate programs that sort of do their own thing. So we spend a whole weekend or even week up in Chicago going to these Ardell's auditions and interviews and auditioning separately for these separate programs. So, you know, I auditioned effectively for like 70 schools and ended up getting accepted into UCSD and NYU.
Nice.
So I was sort of ushered through the whole process in a way, mm-hmm. you know, it was helpful in that regard.
Yeah. What was your experience like at NYU?
Amazing. It was it's an incredible program. Zelda Fitchandler was still there, who founded the Alley Theater and sort of turned NYU into the powerhouse graduate training program that it is. And I think we were among her last class, and she put a lot of effort into her final years being particularly strong, and the faculty was a really powerful unit at that point. It still is from what I understand, but it was intense. You know, it's 6 days a week, 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. depending on rehearsal schedules. And, you know, I don't feel like I actually moved to New York until after that program was over, because yeah. It was so stuffed into those classrooms. And yeah, there are things I would do differently maybe, but, I came out, I think I came out a worse actor than I was going in,
interesting.
But that I'm a better actor now than I would have been had I not gone, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, there is also, you know, I've heard of this where people who have gone to Juilliard say that it kind of like, they had to like unlearn a lot of stuff that they learned at Juilliard when they went.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you sort of, you get all the, I don't know that I had to unlearn anything. I had to, you know, there's something to be said for going right into grad school from undergrad, because mm-hmm. you get it all done. And I mean, it was fucking 7 years of training. I was so done with classes, but.
So
there's something to be said for getting program?
It. Sorry. It was the sorry? Program.
Yeah, and yeah, most graduate programs are 3 years for mm-hmm. acting. Juilliard's 4, which sounds like a nightmare. But but those of my classmates who had been in the real world before coming into the program had a much more useful perspective as to what everything was in service of. Yeah. You know, what I had to, if there's anything I had to unlearn coming out of NYU, it was the sense of like working for a grade or a teacher's approval or something. You know, you had to learn to lean heavily on using all those tools that I received there in pursuit and service of what felt meaningful to me and how I felt I could use them, which was tricky. You know, it was a lot of kind of thrashing and rude awakenings and mm-hmm. Ego checks and,
yeah. Would you said that there was things that you would do differently. Would you give yourself mm-hmm. time between undergrad and graduate school?
I could argue either way. Mm-hmm. I think that probably would have been useful to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
There were also personal entanglements that were involved in that process that, you know, that were a whole other kind of education and,
mm-hmm. Hard to park in New York City, right?
Sorry. Yes. and that, you know, that was, that ended up taking, I might have been more focused, but for those, you know, there would have certainly been less agony during those times and the years after, but also, you know, it brought its own kinds of joys and lessons and stuff. So, you know, it maybe was, it's a different kind of real world experience that has served me now. You know, I don't know that I would change. I don't know that I would change that after. I would, on paper, I would change that if I had to go back. But mm-hmm. like in terms of wisdom in from life experience.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know if I would go back to college. I'm like, it happened. It's done. I've learned what I needed to.
Yeah.
I still hate certain people from college who are horrible. But you know.
Where did you go?
I went to Pace University before it became what it is now, where it's its own performing arts school and all that. So I think when I was there, the program was still being a little bit more built up. And then a few years after I graduated, they're like, we're a performing arts college. Like, we have our own performing arts school. So I don't know if I would have gotten into it if I were to go or attempt to go now. But yeah, uh-huh. I have a BFA in acting and I have a degree in communications and I have a theater podcast and I work in medical. So there we are.
Work in medical. What's the work in medical?
I work for a concierge urgent care company. So I work from home for them. And it's really nice because I get to work from home after
sounds good deal.
Yeah. Well, again, that's why I told you I wanted to look like a human today when I met you virtually, because normally I'm sitting at home. I feel like looking like I'm a gremlin, but it's fine. Anyway, so after you graduated NYU, what was your next step after that? Was there, when you were graduating, you're like, I want to pursue theater in New York, or, cause I know you made your way out to LA, but what was your thing of what you, the trajectory of your career graduating, where did you want to go from there? I should say.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that kind of apropos of not having real world experience
mm-hmm.
before going into grad school, there were some steps laid out in grad school mm-hmm. that I kind of just let happen. They were very useful. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I would have done those differently either, but I would have had a little more ownership of those and maybe a little more intention about what's next, as opposed to like, oh, I can do these things and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Although the whole pursuit of acting is sort of, let's just see what happens. But, you know, they have a showcase at the end of your 3 years. So you put a couple scenes together and do this whole horse and pony show in front of a bunch of agents and casting directors and managers.
Do you remember what you did?
I did a scene from Lobby Hero.
Oh, nice. Did you see the revival on Broadway?
I did. Yes.
I'm
very fond of that play. Oh, it's really good.
I just find it funny. Like only when there's a Kenneth Lonergan play on Broadway is the only time Michael Cera can do Broadway, because he's done three Kenneth Lonergan plays on Broadway.
Has it been three?
Wow. Yeah, it was This Is Our Youth, Lobby uh-huh. Hero, and Waverly Gallery.
Right. Nice. And you just had that right at your fingertips. That's impressive.
Thank you. Theater.
You should do a podcast about theater.
You know, I should. And I should have really cool people on like you.
Totally.
Right?
I did Lobby Hero and then some scene from a 10-minute play that involved me and my classmate Sanjit Silva dancing. Ballroom dancing. So it was hilarious.
Very interesting. Let's do a showcase where we're dancing.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was office party. Oh, look how funny it is that two guys from the office are ballroom dancing together. Really, you know, sophisticated, modern stuff.
Nice.
So we went through that process. You do one in New York, you do one in LA, you hope you get an agent who then tells you what to do. I signed with a lovely woman named Lori Swift, who at that point was with an agency called KGA. But the really lovely thing was the program has a good relationship with the public theater, and particularly, and there's a connection to the Shakespeare in the Park. So each graduating class, and maybe the whole program now, but at least each graduating class at NYU gets to audition for that following summer's Shakespeare in the Park's non-equity ensemble.
Yeah.
Which is such a cool situation. And which so is, I was
want to ask about Shakespeare in the Park, because you do have, yeah. I don't want to say like a huge history with that, but you have performed a couple of times with them. And like, I would love to know what it's like performing at the Delacorte Theater.
It's the best job in New York City.
Yeah,
it really is. Which I found out that summer.
Much ado about nothing, right?
Very good. Yes. Yes. With Kristen Johnston, who I just did a movie with a few years ago, and is the loveliest person. And Jimmy Smits, who just was, I remember that was a very significant experience to see those two work and to see how accessible they were and how curious they were and yeah. how, and that they had insecurities and vulnerabilities about the approach to the work and no assumptions about, you know, being above failure or, you know, having more to offer than anyone else. It was the loveliest summer. So it was like me and like six of my classmates, you know, right out of school, getting to spend, it's like theater summer camp in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And there's just no place like that theater. You know, they don't knock it out of the park every time. I've seen some rough shows at that place and been totally fine with having spent the evening in that environment.
I will say, you don't know me personally, but if you did know me, you would be like, of course that happened to you. The first production I ever saw there, I kind of don't want to name, but it was so bad. And I'm like, of course the first production I see at the Delacorte is horrible. Like, of course it is, because that's just my luck in life. And of course, like the last show I saw before the theater closed because of the pandemic, I did not like, and it was not good. Like, of course it was. Again, not naming names.
No, fair.
Yeah. After, once we're done, I'll let you know. But no, I like the best thing I've ever seen at Shakespeare in the Park was Cymbeline. And it was ironically the best seats I ever had. You had like Raul Esparza doing like a Vegas jazz number. You kind of can't beat that. Yeah.
That's pretty great. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've worked three summers there.
Mm-hmm.
You did done show four shows.
Yeah, one in rep also, right? You did Merchant of Venice and Winter's Tale.
Yes, very good. Yeah, mm-hmm. I did those in rep the same summer.
No, please continue. I can ask my question after.
No, I was just going to say that was after I had come back to New York from LA, and that was a very intensive year and a half of theater.
Yeah. Because you did a lot. That was what, 2010?
That was summer of, yes, 2010.
Yeah, so that was also the orphan's home. That was, am I getting the timeline right or no? Okay.
Yeah, it was
Orphan circle, what is it? Orphan's home, and there was
Orphan's home cycle.
Cycle, yeah. Not circle.
I can tell. Orphan's home cycle is a cycle of nine full-length plays by Horton Foote that in 2009 Hartford Stage, who at that time was AD'd by Michael Wilson, who was close to Horton Foote, and Hallie, his daughter, they, in conjunction with Signature Theater Company here in New York, they commissioned Horton to condense each play into a 50-minute one act, mm-hmm. and then put those together into effectively a 9-hour theater event. So we would do three parts a night for a 3-hour evening, and then there were once we had all of them on their feet, we would do the occasional marathon Saturday where we would start the first part at 11 a.m., break for lunch, start the next, you know, we do all 9 hours over 12 hours and ended up having to take 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. And often it would be the audiences were people who had signed up for all three parts, would do the whole day with us. And it was extraordinary. I could talk about that as much as you want to hear.
Listen, you are welcome back
that was
on
you can
anytime.
Come back to that. So I did a 9-hour play.
Yes.
And then the last month or so of that run overlapped with rehearsal for Shakespeare in the Park. So I was doing a 9-hour play in the evenings and matinees, and then rehearsing two Shakespeare plays for a month. And I went into those plays in rep. And for the last month or more, I think there was 1 6-week period, but overlapping with doing those two plays in rep by at least a month, I was rehearsing both parts of Angels in America. So that was a 6.5-hour piece.
Yeah.
So, and then that ran for that whole next season.
So you like doing long plays that overlap
dense.
And they do it in rep. So that was like that entire year of doing that. So how did the Shakespeare in the Park rep come to you? Did you have to audition for that? And there was also Merchant of Venice that came to Broadway and you did not.
Yes.
Was that because
Because I was doing Angels in America. So when Merchant moved to Broadway, I was doing Angels. How did the rep come about?
Yeah, well, how did that Shakespeare in the Park season come to you? Did they just offer it to you? Did you have to audition for it? If you don't remember, we can move on.
I don't remember. The Orphans Home Cycle was a landmark gig for me.
But let's talk about that then. So how did that come into your life?
Well, which is just to say, I think I sort of re-entered New York in a way that it's possible that the rep just came to me because I had had a relationship with them before. Anyway, how did Orphan's Home Cycle come about?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
I was living in Los Angeles at the time and semi-miserable. And there was a New Works festival called the New Harmony Project, which is a 2-week program in New Harmony, Indiana, which is about 40 minutes from the University of Evansville, where I went to undergrad, and has got connections to that program. And it's in the town of New Harmony, Indiana. It's just this twice failed utopian community that is now this beautiful little town that has a lot of connection to the arts, or a lot of there's like this one there's this one this daughter of like an oil baron in maybe the 70s got it in her head to move to this place and took like a bunch of her father's money to fund all these arts in this small one stoplight town. And it's right on the Wabash, and it's just gorgeous. There's this beautiful inn there, and you come and have like a 2-week intensive developing new plays or screenplays. And I'd done it a few times before, but I did it this summer of 2009. And it had been a really demanding project. And on the way back to Los Angeles, I was in Dallas, a stopover in Dallas, and I got a call from my agents. One of the directors of the New Harmony Project was the associate artistic director at Hartford Stage at the time, and they were looking for this role in the play. It's about Horton Foote's father from age 11 to 39 roughly, and and 7 of the 9 plays are I played this role. There's this role that goes from age 19 to 39, and so it carries through that. So they're looking for this central role, and so I get this call to put 18 pages of theater pages on tape for this play, and I didn't know Horton Foote at the time, and I was so tired, and I was really angry that I had to do this thing, and but I didn't want to ruin the connection I had made at New Harmony Project. And so I agreed to do it and got back to LA and scrambled to put this tape together and sent it in. And then some of my friends back in New York had got wind that I had been pursued for this to some degree and started to call me and be like, this is a huge theater event in New York and in sort of theater art in general. And there was this weird conflagration of events where I had like DVR'd the Tonys and was in LA I watching my recording of the Tonys in the afternoon and got this call from my good friend, this extraordinary playwright, Matt Smart, who was like, I hear that you that there's some interest in you for this Orphans Home cycle. Don't be an asshole. Like, here's what it means. Here's what it is. Here is, you know, kind of the scope and the stakes of this project. He wasn't connected to it at all. He just had sort of heard and wanted to make sure I knew what it was. So I was like, oh, okay. And then I come back in and keep watching the Tonys and.
Oh no, you froze. Out. My internet went out, so we're back at it. So the orphan circle is kind of a big deal for you because that's where you also met your wife, which is pretty great.
Pretty great.
Yeah.
Yes. My wife, Maggie Lacey,
mm-hmm.
who I was
actor.
Played opposite,
mm-hmm.
and a beautiful, incredible actor, who I played opposite, to whom I played opposite in the Orphans Home Cycle. Our characters, you know, over the course of this 9-hour play, our court characters meet in court and marry and have a family and have loss. And as they sort of come together, this is, you know, effectively Horton Foote's parents who had this legendary marriage. And we decided we'd. So we had like this 10-month, the run was like 10 months. So we had like this 10-month tryout for the rest of our lives. And it stuck.
Good thing that it did. Hold on, sorry. I'm just like closing all of these applications that I had open in a panic to try and like get back onto the Zoom thing. I was like, oh, no, what's happening? So I love Angels in America. So I would love to know, and I unfortunately missed that production because it was either like too expensive because, you know, just
no signature theater, no,
or
no signature
like
theater,
couldn't get tickets or something. It was one of the two. It's probably a couple of tickets, but how did that come into your life?
I think that sort of going back to what you're asking about how that summer at the park came, you know, Orphans Home Cycle raised my status. Within the relatively small theater community in New York City, or at least, you know, got me out into the world a little more. And so Tony Kushner had seen the Orphans Home Cycle and because I'd had a relationship with Signature Theater, that production of Angels was also a Signature Theater. You know, they asked me to come in on audition and it happened.
So you just like doing the long shows at the Signature Theater. So when you
I
go back,
guess so. They're like, this asshole will give his life up for our long play.
So next show at the Signature, it has to be 3 hours or more, or I won't. And it has.
Well,
to
I
be.
Then did like a 2.5 hour play there, which was.
Oh well, that's not so. Which show was that one?
That was Night as a Room, by Naomi Wallace. That was a few years after. It was like 2014 or something. Is that right? With and out and Dagmar Dominic, and that was a shorter one. That's where the green contacts came from.
Oh, got
you
it.
Mentioned earlier,
because I was trying to figure out the timeline of that with the contacts. Like, I don't remember Joe Pitt them talking about him having green eyes.
No,
at all.
No, but they do in Night as a Room by Naomi Wallace.
Nice. So I really loved how you had different casts for Angel. So how was that for you? Because you got to make out like Zachary Quinto and then Adam Driver. I'm not saying like
Yeah,
did,
the two
but
major hunks of the two major sci-fi movie
isn't
franchises. I
that
mean, how about that?
crazy? Like one
Pretty
of them has
incredible.
like an Oscar nomination now, and the other one has amazing eyebrows that could win Oscars.
It
Yeah.
was good.
No, please, after you.
No, it was I was going to say educational experience, which it really was, but that makes it sound like that's sort of a backhand compliment. But I
No,
learned so
I.
much from that experience. There was like, I think a 6 month initial run.
Yeah.
And then because it was selling so well, they extended by a month and a half or 2 months.
Yeah.
And much of the cast was unable to do that. In fact, I think Billy Porter and I were the only ones who were able to stay through the entirety of the run.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was fantastic. You know, they were extremely different performers,
Yeah.
and with very different interpretations of the character. You know, not only Adam and Zach, who played they played Lewis. But Jonathan Hadar came in for Frank Wood, playing Roy Cohn, and you know, on and on. And everyone was fantastic. You know,
Yeah.
it was a lot of it was funny to have to go back into rehearsal, but enjoyable. It was nice
Yeah.
to really dig deep into something for 6 months, and then to have to dig, oh, you know, a whole new set of excavations, a whole
Yeah.
set of caves into to the depth of the play. And obviously the play, you know, can
Yeah.
hold up to any excavation you care to take.
Yeah.
It has an immense range to it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a perfect playground for that sort of thing.
Yeah. Were you just comparing notes when you saw the revival? Like, oh, I did that better. No, I'm just joking.
Totally.
Well, I know
Although
you have a little, yeah.
I did take, huh?
No, I was, I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, there was something in that revival. This is the Broadway revival, which was, I think, 5 years after our signature. I think ours was like the 20th anniversary, and this was the Broadway's, that was the 25th anniversary that came from London. There was something in that that was very meaningful to me. There's a scene in the first part, a millennium approaches. You know, Joe Pitt was the character that I played, falls in love with Lewis, and Joe is this Mormon, and all this drama happens, and then you go, they end up at the beach, at the Rockaways or something, and Lewis is effectively saying, "I can't see you anymore. I'm breaking up with you. I'm ending this affair." And Joe is devastated. This is sort of the only thing that he has found that makes him feel alive and who he is. And so, in this scene at the beach, he takes off his clothes, and there are, you know, for those who don't know, there are these very holy Mormon undergarments. It's essentially a white t-shirt and boxers that you do not take off. That is an extremely intimate thing for those to come off in any circumstance outside of like in the shower or with your wife. And he takes off these Mormon undergarments and this and is naked in front of Lewis is this gesture of total vulnerability and giving over. And it's this, you know, it's this moment of desperation, and you know, he's looking into the maw of returning to his meaningless, lonely existence without love. And you know, that so that is a really intense kind of angsty, potentially angsty moment that was, you know, cost a lot, but was also very exciting to do when I was doing it. And in the revival, Lee Pace, who plays Joe Pitt, in that scene, he added to that he added this layer of joy and freedom to finally to say, see what you have given me, that I can do this, and that here I am, here's all of me. And he leapt with joy and freedom on top of all this other stuff. It blew my mind. I thought it was such a beautiful choice, and I felt like such a stupid actor for not seeing that possibility when I did it. But it really struck me and really stuck with me, and I thought it was just gorgeous. And I just finished this run of Take Me Out on Broadway, when the offer, which involves a lot of nudity and a good amount of time in the showers on stage.
We're not getting to that scene, but we'll get to the show at some point.
Okay. In any case, that meaningful moment for me, I then I went back to touch onto when I was thinking, well, do I want to get butt ass naked in front of thousands of people again? And I thought back to Lee making that choice. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do it, like, I better be free with it. And, you know, engage with what that could mean in a totally different context in this play, instead of worrying about what it means for a lot of people seeing my junk.
I was there. I saw the moment. Sorry, I don't know how
you
to
saw the moment.
Like, not awkward to be like, eh, I'm gonna go on stage. I actually, when I saw the show, I have a scar on my leg from the night I saw your show, because this girl sitting next to me had her bag underneath the chair and the back strap was out. So I was getting out of the row to let somebody in, and I tripped on the back strap and fell on my knees. And I thought I bruised my knees, but I just like scraped my knee on my pants, and I had a bruise there. And so now I have this like very faded little scar. So whenever I'm like, yep, that's from when I saw Take Me Out the second time. The show and
we'll be with you. It'll always.
Always be like, oh, that time Bill had like Joe Pitt moment on stage. It was so great. I just, honestly, because I saw the show when it was first on Broadway, not that many years ago. But the new revival when it was at Second Stage, and it only got better when came back. So it was exciting. And I also, again, I'm an admirer of yours, so when you were going into the show, I was very excited. It's like,
thank you,
Bill Heck in the show, he's gonna be so good. Yeah, anyway, we'll get to it. So I want to talk about Cabaret, and it's very interesting that you said working with, you know, new cast members for Angels in America was a big learning experience, because you got to interact with three different Sally Bowleses.
Yes, I did. Five, if you count the covers, which you absolutely should.
Yeah, yes, for sure. Yeah. How did that come into your life? A musical on Broadway, even though you sang maybe one line in the show, if memory serves me correctly.
I sang more than one line in the show.
Or a couple
I
of
sang
lines.
Maybe
two.
And there's a whole duet.
Oh, that's right. It's just, you know what? There's still clips on YouTube you can find of like Emma Stone in the show.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm. People take them down pretty quickly, but yeah, they're around.
Yeah, that happens. They just asked me to audition. You know, the part of Cliff in that, you know, that's this is the Sam Mendes version, which is definitely
the
its own
revival
version.
Of the revival.
You know, there's
and
it's he spent a lot of time restructuring it. Mm-hmm. You know, there Cliff does originally have a solo that is not in it. And this, the version he put together, is very much structured by the hosting of the MC, who is Alan Cumming, sort of centralizes him in this structural way in the service of telling the story of Sally Bowles. So even though the original structure is like Cliff comes to Germany and has this whole experience, he's sort of becomes this, even more so in that production, becomes the stand-in for the audience. So he's sort of a narrator of sorts, or not really a narrator, but he's kind of the protagonist that you follow through, but it's very much in service of exploring who Sally is and creating room for the MC. So there's great stuff to do with the part, but it's also very functional. It's not the part you cast the movie star in. It's the part you get someone who has experience in the theater, and, you know, relative technical abilities to ground some things. So they were just looking for a reliable theater performer, basically. I can carry enough of a tune that I can get through, you know, the 64 bars that I had to sing. It doesn't require a Phantom of the Opera voice.
Listen, if that's what you aspire for, why not, right?
Hey, well, that ship has sailed.
You know, I'm sure there will be productions of it somewhere in the world.
This is true.
I mean, it's still happening in other places.
Anyway, so they just, that's just something I auditioned for, and it worked out. And it was this wild year of my life.
I do have to ask this because I would feel very like, I should have. So Emma Stone has famously talked about how she lost both of her contacts on stage during a performance. And I just want to get your side of the story of it. Cause she's like, I sing, maybe this time both of my contacts fell out, couldn't see a thing, lights go out. I'm screaming, Bill, Bill. And she was saying like, Bill's like, what? And you had to like take her off stage or something. Do you remember this happening?
As I'm trying it, this is a long time ago now.
If you don't remember, fine. I just, you know,
I mean, that's effectively the story. That I think what also happened in that moment, and maybe I'm conflating this with another story, but was before I got to her on her way out, she brained herself on one of the steel spiral staircases on the edge of the stage and like opened a nice gash in the side of her head.
That was Sienna Miller. Sorry, I only
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Bye.
And we'll cut this last. No, I say
that because I was actually there that night because my friend.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, no. So I have a friend who's actually a dresser at Cabaret, and she was Sienna Miller's dresser at the time. And we were going to go backstage and say hi. And so the night my old roommate and I were there.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, my friend like couldn't really like see us because that's what happened to Sienna Miller. Because Sienna Miller has also publicly talked about how she like smacked her face and like cut her eye.
Yes, of course, that's right.
I'm sorry.
Yes, I remember Emma Stone losing her contacts and having to guide her off stage, and that was story. That was the entirety.
Thanks for
of
coming
the story.
On. That was great. Any mishaps with Michelle Williams that we can share? No.
Nothing like that. Yeah, she's great. I mean, probably. It was a long time. You know, there's a long run. It's bound to be. I should have thought on it. I would have prepared something meatier for you.
It's again, you're welcome back to talk about the orphan home cycle. Hopefully my internet won't go out again.
Stick with it. That was an amazing show. And the three very different performers, all of extraordinary talent and variety. And you know, it made doing the show for nearly a year a lot fresher than it would have been.
For sure.
And Alan was such a spectacular kind of big brother to the whole thing. You know, he would make soup every Wednesday. We'd have soup parties after the show on Wednesdays. And
that was the birthplace of Club Cumming.
That was the genesis. Yes, there's still that neon. They put a neon sign outside of what was his dressing
around
room.
The corner. It's still there.
Studio 54.
Yeah, I just realized Danny Burstein is back at Studio 54 right now.
Yes. That's a great theater. I love that theater.
I will never sit rear mezzanine of that theater ever again, though. But I agree. Rear mezz is horrible.
What happened?
Oh no, it's just horrible up there. Just rear mezzanine.
Is that where you saw Cabaret?
No, I saw Brief Encounter. in the rear scene. Did you ever see that?
I didn't.
Sorry. It was really good. It's like one of my top going things
Shocker.
I've ever seen.
Oh,
But
yeah? Oh, nice.
yeah.
Nice. Who was your dresser friend? I'm
Lacey,
trying to think who's.
Whitney.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm friends with her and her husband. I'm actually a part of their engagement story. I, like, weaseled my way
Hey.
in there. Yeah. He put her on a
Nice.
scavenger hunt and I dropped off the first clue.
Well done.
Thank you. I was like,
Well
here you
done.
go, bye. And I like ran away. And then I called him, like, clue has been dropped off. So,
Nice.
yes.
Essential.
Yes. So I want to ask about the movie Pit Stop because you won an award for it, which I cannot remember the
Okay.
award that you won. Or we don't have to talk about it. Do you not remember you
No,
won?
that's totally fine.
Yeah. How
No,
did it?
I wasn't there to receive it.
Oh, well, you surprise, you won an award for it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was at Outfest in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But I was doing a job out here.
Okay.
So maybe doing cabaret.
How does
Yeah, no,
sound? Yeah.
that was a lovely movie. I think very fondly of that movie.
Yeah.
Written directed by Yen Tan, and we shot it out in Austin. That was my first feature, second feature. But I had a it's a gorgeous,
Yeah.
quiet, gentle film. A real beautiful piece that we took to Sundance, and I, have very grateful for that one.
Yeah, and it is a
Lifelong
very good
friends.
movie. I did watch it many moons ago, and then I like rediscovered it again in my research. But you can watch it on Amazon Prime if anybody is
Yes,
listening and wants to
go
check it
for it.
out. Let's talk
Yes.
about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Am I saying it correctly? Shrugs?
Scruggs.
Scruggs. Damn it. I always mess up names. I'm sorry. But I always think of the Oscars. When it, the year they had no host and it was Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph, and Tina Fey came out to like open the awards, and they're like, Buster Scruggs, I hardly know her. So every time I hear the title of that movie, I always think of that joke from the Oscars. So how did that movie come into your life? Because that's a big deal. It's a Coen brother film.
Yeah, no, that was a huge deal.
And
That,
that this goes back to the tumbleweed thing. Because Oregon
yes,
Trail,
right.
yeah.
It was a Western, though not in the desert, which is where the tumbleweeds tend to be, on the prairies.
Yeah. One of the segments
That
that
was
you,
just an audition.
yeah.
That was just an audition that which only happened because they had had an A-list name attached to that role. It's a really good role. It's an anthology film, so like
Yeah.
five different shorter films, and the section I was in was the longest section, and it was a central role in that section. So, and the other parts were filled with these, big old names. So it would have stood to reason that this part would have been as well. But the gentleman who was attached to that had a family tragedy and had to drop out, and so they just auditioned people. And that's how it happened. And I, the what was really lovely, one of the many, many lovely things about that was, I went in for the initial reading and then came in to do a call back with, I think, three or four women who I would potentially play opposite. And as I was at the Film Center over here on 9th Avenue, and as I was down in the lobby checking in, I came in, and there was a slight woman in a prairie dress, and I knew before she turned around that it was Zoe Kazan, who I had played opposite with in Angels in America. And I knew, I was like, oh shit, she's going in for that movie. And we had a lovely reunion, and we were able to read together, and it was I think in large part why it all happened is because we had this history that we were able to draw on
And her
for the
prairie
movie.
outfit, I think, probably helped
The
too.
prayer outfit sold it, man.
I feel like
Sold
Target
it.
apparently sells like prairie dresses now. I see on Instagram, they're like, let's go
This
to
was
Target.
pre-Target Prairie Lines, yes.
Pre-Target Prairie Line. Well, maybe that movie made it a thing. You don't
Maybe.
know.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's
Yeah. So we do have
it.
a few minutes left. So let's talk about Take Me Out. How did that come into your life? Was that a factor with the first revival, or was it
Was
like,
that what?
Because when it was first on Broadway at Second Stage, was that even an inkling, or was it just come
no,
around?
I no, it can't, it can't. You know, it was one of the first plays I ever saw on Broadway back in 2003. While I was in school. And so I was so excited to hear it was coming back, you know, pre-pandemic when it was first set to go. And when I think they were like 3 weeks into rehearsal, if not longer. Obviously that got put on hiatus, and then they came back and they closed the night before the Tonys, where they won Best Revival, and Jason Tyler Ferguson won Best Actor, and Michael Oberholzer and Jesse Williams had both been nominated. So it's this big deal. And I think because of that, a commercial producer saw that it was a viable commodity and he loved the show and wanted to bring it back. But Patrick J. Adams, who played the part of Kippy, was not able to return with it. And so it just came to me because the director, Scott Ellis, back in 2007 gave me my first significant television role when I was living out in LA, a two-part arc on The Closer. And so I've known him for a long time, and his husband, Scott Drummond, is an even older friend of my wife, Maggie Lacey's, that they knew each other before I knew either of them. So we have a good history with these fellas, and they needed someone. And Scott, not kind of unlike the cabaret context, was just wanted someone reliable who he knew he could bring in and who could you know, do a sufficient job to keep the production running. So it just came to me kind of out of the blue, which was, and I was so excited to go see it, and it closed, you know, I was unable to see it for some scheduling things, and then it closed earlier than I thought it was going to. So I was heartbroken when it closed and I missed it. And then when it came to me, it was this beautiful kind of reprieve. And that one, it was a really special gig. It was one of those ones where just kind of, it fires on all cylinders. You know, it's rare you get a production where the material is excellent, where the production of the material is excellent, where the cast is excellent across the board, and they all like each other, and the audiences like it. Usually there's at least one of those things that's at least, you know, slightly lacking. But this, it was just a dream, and it was so good. I'd say that without any, you know, that's to be just a part of that was... that's one that'll be very dear to me, that I'll carry with me for a long time.
You can tell definitely that the cast, how close they are and hopefully still are, even though you guys closed.
No, we have a whole text thread. We've still been texting. You know, we closed on Sunday, but we've still been going at it.
Did your say anything moment? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, I will bring the applause app somewhere in 10th or 11th or 12th or 9th Avenue, wherever you live, not to give anything away. Oh my God, why am I brain farting? Where did the cardboard cutouts come into play backstage?
Yes, they're full size cardboard cutouts of much of the cast. Yeah.
Yeah. Cutout was at the after party.
Because I was unable to go.
Yeah.
So they brought my cardboard cutout and fed him drinks. There was you know, plays on Broadway have been struggling to sell. And we did well through the run relative to other plays on Broadway, but still not as well as, you know, the producers certainly would have hoped in terms of ticket sales. The last several weeks were excellent, but, you know, and the holidays were good, but there were times. So one of the sales initiatives they got was to invite a bunch of like influencers and have this whole event for Instagram and TikTok folk. So they had like a drinks thing, and they had these cutouts for them to take pictures with in the back of the house and at the bar. And then they made their way backstage and, you know, were defaced and vandalized and scandalized in all manner of ways that No one but us will ever know.
How is your, what's your feeling on the Yonder bags?
Great.
Yeah.
Love it.
The
Love
first
it.
time I saw the show, I was sitting next to this woman and she was, I don't want to say she was going on a tirade, but she was, I very much disagreed with her point of view on why we needed these bags, because she was saying how she felt as though they're dumbing down their audience, where they're not trusting their audience to put their phones away. And I was like, it's probably, you know, like theater people like us will turn off our phones and, you know, do the proper thing and know what it's like to, before phones were a thing, talking and interacting with people at intermission as opposed to being on their phones the whole time. But there are other people out there who are just coming to see it for certain reasons. So
yeah, no, it's definitely of necessity, you know. Yes, there were plenty, there are plenty of respectful people who came, and you know, but the Yonder bags, for those who don't know, they're like, lock your phone in a little baggie for the entirety of the performance, then you unlock it for you on your way back out. And it was engaged primarily for our production because there's a lot of naked men, and even though they had done that in the previous run, somebody had snuck something in. I think they think it was like some, you know, glasses or something.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And now they have the
taken.
They installed the cameras and everything.
Right. So not only were people's phones locked, but there were cameras looking at the audience that people would monitor just for the privacy of the actors. But, you know, the other thing that it gives is there were a lot fewer phones going off, because that would still happen on occasion. But, you know, there, because there's a dedicated check of your phone on the way going in, a lot of phones went off, and there's just a different kind of attentiveness generally, especially coming back from intermission, because people haven't spent their intermission on their phone. They've spent their intermission engaging with each other about what's just happened, you know, looking through the playbill. So they're still very much in the experience of the play. In a way that is compromised generally. I think it should happen in every play. Or at least, you know, it's
maybe your
it
next
really,
Broadway experience, you know, whatever it is.
Was
a couple of years your Broadway return. What do you want to do next? So because we're kind of coming towards the end. What do you want to do next? Or do you have something lined up already?
You
have the old man, right?
Yes, season two of The Old Man. I won't do as much this season, but I'll do a few episodes of that.
How long are they giving you to grow out your hair and your beard for this?
I don't know. I haven't been scheduled yet. So there probably will definitely at least have to be some wigging, but we won't tell. So that'll come up just before Take Me Out. I did a small part in a movie with Sarah Paulson. That'll come out at some point. There's another couple of things that are looking like they might happen that I can't talk about at the moment, but it's on camera stuff for the moment is next, so we'll see.
Do you hope to do more theater in the future, maybe like another season
of Shakespeare? I'm done.
Oh, you're done.
No, for sure. I'll always come back.
Nothing can top Take Me Out.
If there was one to finish on.
This one.
No, I'll definitely stay in the theater. It's my first love.
Yeah, I think Stephen Pasquale said he does like film and TV to like benefit his theater.
To fund
habit.
His theater habit.
Yeah, yeah, to fund his theater habit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that stuff too. I really do.
Yeah.
But
do you have any like dream projects or dream roles that you would want to tackle?
Nope.
Cool. What are your top theater experiences that you've had?
I mean, sure. I don't know. I, you know, a part of the thing I like about the job is the unexpected and the new. So, if I sat and thought about it, sure.
Anybody you want to work with? Because you've worked with pretty amazing people. I did want to ask, I mean, we don't really have time, but because you talked about your first time working at Shakespeare in the Park, and then you got to work with Al Pacino. So what was that experience like?
Incredible. you know, he was as open and available and hardworking as anyone else. And you know, I mean, there's always sort of the Pacino of it.
Yeah.
And just in terms of his iconic status, you know, their presence. But as much as you could want or imagine, he just was interested in being a part of the company and was curious. And, you know, he held a screening. He this film Wild about a production of Oscar Wilde. You know, he's like, he's sort of, speaking of Stephen Pasquale, is him, that guy, his
that
quote.
Person. The Fuentes theater habit, yes.
You know, a lot of the bigger movies he does, he says, is to fund his theater and small film habits. And so he's still an extremely curious, hardworking artist, and that infuses itself into the whole experience.
Yeah, that just reminds me when I did merch at Nice Work, If You Can Get It, the actors would be on stage doing warm-ups, and James Earl Jones would actually be on stage with the entire cast doing warm-ups with them, which I thought was so cool.
He is one of the most amazing people I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
He is, I did Night of the Iguana up at ART with him, that Michael Wilson also directed, who did Orphan's Home Cycle. And he was, you know, just leagues above any, as curious and humble, as invested as a kid just out of undergrad. I mean, you know, we would have these talkbacks, and he wouldn't participate because that's a little tricky for he was, you know, getting older, and so he would be tired and also gets a lot of stupid questions, but he would hang out in the wings backstage to listen to the talkbacks because he was just curious.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are all these lines of his that come from sort of out of this little cabana that he could have easily recorded, and everyone would have been cool with it. It wouldn't have compromised the production at all. And he insisted on sitting back there every night and doing them live, you know, just kept trying new things. And just that man is one of the truest artists I've ever known.
Yeah. What are, aside from working with him, what are some of your top going theater experiences that you've had?
The one that I always comes right to mind was a production of The Pillow Man by Martin McDonagh back in,
is that the one with Billy Crudup?
Yeah, Billy Crudup and Michael Stuhlbarg and Jeff Goldblum. And, because it's an amazing play. It's an incredible play. It was an incredible production. It's the only time there are these tableaus that occur suddenly. And this production, it was like this big interrogation room, this huge, like, concrete looking walls. And at a couple of moments, there were a few moments referenced a story being told on stage. And this panel, like high up in the back of the wall, would open up onto these tableaus that were terrifying. I mean, truly horrifying. And the audience would react like we were in a horror movie. And I think probably the hardest thing to do in the theater is to genuinely scare your audience. And that blew me away that they achieved that to such a huge degree. And it felt very meaningful to me that they went full out to achieve these different modes of expression that were really impactful. So that one is special to me. I remember a production called Orange Flower Water off Broadway with Jason Butler Harner. That was really
I read that play in college. Yeah. Oh, I feel like a lot of people don't know of that play.
It was a big off Broadway event at the time, but it hasn't really come back that I don't think, but it's really kind of extraordinary play. And that night there's like magic in the play, and there was a magician consult. I think I went on some night where, wait, am I conflating that with another play? Is there magic in that play?
I don't think so. But
Never mind.
maybe there was something with the orange
Never
flat
mind. Never
water.
mind.
Oh,
Yeah.
the prologue said it was spilt in the car or something.
Yeah. Never mind. No, but I remember Jason Butler's Horner's performance was quite striking in that. And as a young artist, like just out of school, and it made me excited about the future.
All right, you ready for the Actor Studio questions
Hit
for
me.
this bad boy? All right. What is your favorite word?
You mentioned your sister went to Northwestern University.
Yes.
I applied for Northwestern, and their application process is very involved, and there's a very long packet. And one of the questions, short essay questions, was, "What's your favorite word and why?" And I answered slaughter, because, which still may be true, I don't know. But the word slaughter, what I love about it is it drips with its meaning. It is so evocative of its definition in this really visceral way. There's just blood in your mouth when you say slaughter.
Did you
And
bring that
that's
into
something.
your Shakespeare in the Park as Hector? That
Oh,
one
for
sentence?
sure. For
Perfect.
sure. That was a fun one.
Yeah, what was that
Anyway,
called? His Titus.
looking back,
I'm sorry.
Titus, or not to, no, Troilus and Cressida.
Thank you, because I couldn't pronounce it. So I appreciate you
No,
doing that.
of course. But anyway, looking back, I didn't get into Northwestern, and I don't know that it's because of this, but I was like, maybe that's a major red flag for like an incoming student to be like, "I love the word slaughter." So I've in my in the story of my history, that's why Northwestern wouldn't accept me. Because anyway, I love the word slaughter. I think it's
Perfect.
just in the lo as a theater artist where you learn that language is God.
Yeah. Like I
It's just a
slaughtered that
great
performance. It was great.
slaughter. It's just
Yeah.
it's a dense word.
Yes. What is your least favorite word?
Kinda. It's KINDA,
No, I know.
maybe
I'm
not in the
trying to
dictionary,
think if I
but
said it at all during this podcast interview. I might
no,
have.
there was a period of my life where I would insert that as a qualifier into a lot of my speech. Maybe I still do. And I started to notice that it was in a lot of other people's speech. I didn't know if it was just sort of a pervasive sort of, that's the other one. This qualifier that's unnecessary, that is hesitant, that is not full in. And that's just no way to move forward in your life. To qualify everything.
What turns you on?
I'm thinking of a
Okay,
very specific experience of my wife.
so James Lipton would ask this question. People are like, oh, I think Daniel Radcliffe was like, what, sexually? And it's like, these are your students. They're here to learn. But the full actual, from what I have on my computer, is what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally. But I always put what turns you on questionnaire, because that's how he used to ask it. You could say your wife, that's fine. I mean, Amy Poehler, I think, said her
My wife
ex-husband's voice
definitely
at the time. There you go. We can move
my
on.
wife definitely turns me on. Sure, let's keep
All
it
right,
that.
moving on.
Maggie Lacey turns me on.
Boom. What turns you off? Someone who is not your wife.
Yes, everyone else.
Boom. Well, it's great interviewing you. Have a good day.
yes. Antipathy. There's something sort of re there's a trend recently that I have bought into that's found largely on social media, kind of a kind of, do you know that? An expression of exhaustion or or insecurity or it's a sense of unsurety that is comically available.
Yeah.
Will I ever get it? And
I could go
there
on
because of it's there because of the pandemic and completely like a coping mechanism, I think, society wide. And I have indulged in it and appreciated it and found it funny and connected to it. And of late, I'm starting to be like, is this just sort of what, now it's become an excuse for us to to not move forward, to let ourselves off the hook. And there's, you know, I think things like self-care and space for that trauma and weakness is really important. But in its place, in the space that there is for it, it has seems that it has overwhelmed things to enough of a degree that people are starting to at least seem like they're starting to lose their self-possession or sense of personal responsibility to how they're contributing to the world and walking through it. And so I've become very skeptical and turned off by that because, you know, in large part because I see how easy it is to fall into that and how I've let myself get lazier off the hook because of that. And I'm tired of it.
I will say, because I 100% agree with you. And I feel like when you are on, I only have Instagram and Facebook, but with Instagram, you're constantly seeing the same shit over and over again. And so much of the same, like, oh, I'm not going to do that. But 100% of what you're saying, and it's constantly the same stuff over and over. Okay. Moving on. What is your favorite curse word?
God, you know, I haven't seen this show, this actor's TV show forever. And I had one that I was like, if that ever happens, I'm going to say it. And I forget what it is.
Okay, so you're going to go on Instagram.
Oh, you know what? You know what? Now I remember. and I don't know that this is to all that acceptable. There is... But it's sort of in the vein of slaughter. It feels very evocative. Listen, as a cis white male, I don't know how this comes off. So maybe you can help guide me. But it is a total appreciation of. But I love. I think the word twat is great, and it can be. Aggressive, it can be like appreciative.
It's a you know, British thing, so that's
yeah,
acceptable. I think, but
it's so staccato and so.
Trying to remember what Samuel Barnett's was. I think it was similar to that when I asked him. I don't remember, but I feel like. Twat is fine. It's again, it's British.
Yeah, but it's like it's got that hard T and then wah, and then another hard T. It's rangy while being economical and sharp. I think it's kind of great.
What sound or noise do you love?
Having grown up, it's a little cliche, but having grown up in the desert. Through much of my early childhood, rain was a very meaningful event. So rain and thunder, and those bring me right back.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Well, I have two young boys, so whining. has become a part of my life than I'd like.
Yeah.
And also because it's that thing where your children remind you of the worst parts, you know, the worst parts of your children or just remind you of the worst parts of yourself and actually aren't a bad part of the children. It's more about your own trouble with your own shortcomings. And now I know that I can whine sometimes.
We all can, but we just, you know,
we all can
and we do, and it's fine. What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Carpentry.
What profession would you not like to do?
Politics.
And finally, as Mr. Lipton would say, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh man. Well, there's my bare leg. I can only think of really cheesy things.
Whatever you feel in your heart that you want to say, it's fine.
You have the power of flight? I don't know.
You go fly.
I
That is the best answer I have ever
don't
heard out of all of the Inside the Actor Studios, out of times I have asked people, and I think we should just end the questionnaire there. I do have one more question
it.
before we end. Why do you think theater is important?
It's one of the few places anymore where people come together in person to experience one thing in an infinite amount of different ways. And that is one of the primary and earliest centerpieces of what it means to create a civilization. I think, and that sounds so high flung, but I think it's actually mundane in this way that it's just essential, the storytelling, that word gets thrown around a lot. But and just like in the same way, people learn to build shelter and plant food. It's been a central part of what holds us together as people. So I think in a very essential way, it's just essential. It's in a very small base, necessary structural way. It's just part of the fabric of what holds us together. So it's about as important a thing there is, without being pretentious or spectacular, or there's something that's very baseline functional about it. And I think that's really cool that a functional element can take you to the loftiest of heights. And also just be as basic as a meal.
Wonderful. Anything else you want to add before we end the evening or afternoon, I should say?
Good. Gotta go pick up my kids.
All right, cool. Well, I'm going to stop recording. You can hang on.